Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This morning we continue reading from Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 11, Jadbharata instructs King Rahugana, text 9. Ekadashasan manaso hivrittaya akutaya pancha dhiyo bhimana matrani karmani puram chatasam vadanti hai kadasha vira bhumi ekadashasan manaso hivrittaya akutaya pancha dhiyo bhimana matrani karmani puram chatasam vadanti hai kadasha vira bhumi. Ekadashasan manaso hivrittaya akutaya pancha dhiyo bhimana matrani karmani puram chatasam virabhum ekadasho san manaso hivritte nakutaya pancha dhiyo bhimana matrani karmani puram chatasam vadanti hai kadasha vira bhumi. Vaishnavas. Ekadashasan manaso hivrittaya akutaya pancha dhiyo bhimana matrani karmani puram chatasam vadanti hai kadasha vira bhumi ekadashasan manaso hivrittaya akutaya pancha dhiyo bhimana matrani karmani puram chatasam vadanti hai kadasha vira bhumi. Ekadasha, 11. Asan, there are. Manasa, of the mind. He, certainly. Vrittaya, activities. Akutaya, senses of action. Pancha, 5. Dhiya, senses for gathering knowledge. Abhimana, the false ego. Matrani, different sense objects. Karmani, different material activities. Puramcha, and the body. And the body, society, nation, family, or place of nativity. tasam of those functions. Vadanti, they say, ha, o, ekadasha, 11, vira, o hero, bhumi, fields of activity. Translation. There are 5 working senses and 5 knowledge acquiring senses. There is also the false ego. In this way, there are 11 items for the mind's functions. O hero, the object of the senses, such as sound and touch, the organic activities, such as evacuation, and the different types of bodies, society, friendship, and personality, are considered by learned scholars the fields of activity for the functions of the mind. Purport. The mind is the controller of the 5 knowledge acquiring senses and the 5 working senses. Each sense has its particular field of activity. In all cases, the mind is the controller or owner. By the false ego, one thinks oneself the body and thinks in terms of my body, my house, my family, my society, my nation, and so on. These false identifications are due to the expansion of the false ego. Thus one thinks that he is this or that. Thus the living entity becomes entangled in material existence. Ekadasha san manaso hi vrittaya akutaya pancha dhiyo bhimana matrani karmani puram chatasam vadanti haikadasha vira bhumi. There are 5 working senses and 5 knowledge acquiring senses. There is also the false ego. In this way, there are 11 items for the mind's function. O hero, the object of the senses, such as sound and touch, the organic activities, such as evacuation, and the different types of bodies, society, friendship, and personality, are considered by learned scholars the fields of activity for the functions of the mind. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Mukham Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langayate Girim Yat Kripa Tamaham Vande Shri Gurum Dinataranam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. I've always found this a particularly difficult chapter. Not entirely, just because the subject matter is particularly difficult, or particularly difficult to comprehend, but particularly because the chapter, because of the context in which the chapter occurs. In the previous chapter, we've heard how there was a king called Rahugana. And the hero that is addressed here, the Vira in the last line, there's this king, and he came across this man who was seemingly like a mad person, who was seemingly dumb and silent and sort of didn't really interact with the world around him, and he decided to enlist this person as his palanquin carrier, the carrier of the seat on which the king travels, and the madman, or the person who appears to be mad, agrees to this and starts carrying the palanquin of the king. But whenever it's not going very well, because every time this person sees an ant running in front of him, he tries to avoid stepping on the ant, and sometimes the Bhagavatam says he actually stops, and sometimes he moves aside, and so the palanquin is not going very well. There's 4 people carrying it, and if one person doesn't move in line with the others, then it's very uncomfortable for the king, and so the king gets very upset and chastises this person, and this person suddenly reveals that he's not quite mad and he's actually very sane. And he says, actually, you think I'm a madman and you want to beat me, you want to punish me for misbehaving. But he says, this won't do anything to me because I'm a self-realized person. My name is Bharata, as Jada Bharata, the dull Bharata. And whatever you'll do to me, it won't affect me. The king immediately realizes the king has some piety, the king has some wisdom, actually. And the king realizes that he's been engaging a great saint in his own service. And so immediately he offers respects to Jad Bharata. And he says, please forgive me, I didn't know you were such a great personality. Please be kind to me, please. And he tells him, please explain to me how I can make advancement on the spiritual path. But then immediately after that, he expresses his doubts about what Bharata has been saying him. Jad Bharata, he was telling him that if you want to punish me, go ahead, I don't care. This will have no effect on me. If you think I'm a madman, then if you punish a madman, no good results come from it. I mean, the madman will not listen. And if you think I'm not a madman, then even your punishment will have no effect, because I'm a self-realized person and I realize that whatever punishment you will give me will not affect me. He says, pleasure and pain have no effect on the self, on the soul. They do not touch them. And Maharaj Raghuguna, he responds, and he says a number of things that are quite insightful in some ways. And he starts by saying, after he asked him that, please instruct me, he says, but actually what you've told me doesn't make much sense, so please explain this to me. He says, you've said that the bodily designations like fatness or thinness and all the characteristics that go with the body are really just belonging to the body and do not touch the self. But he says, I don't quite understand this, because we see that we do suffer. When the body suffers, then I suffer. I feel the pain that this body feels, even though the pain is not my own pain. And he continues to explain that, he says, you mentioned that really that all these things that have to do with the body have no real reality, and therefore the fact that I'm a king and that you're the carrier of my palanquin are illusory. And he says, I accept this. They're illusory in the sense that they're temporary and they won't last forever. And at some point I will die and I will no longer be king. And at some point you will die and you will no longer be my servant. But still, I don't think what you're saying is entirely right, because I am still king. And with that role of a king comes a certain duty, and so I have to act in a certain way, and I have to act responsibly, so I have to take my role as a king seriously in order to live a good life. And therefore, I don't quite understand what you mean. And I find this chapter particularly difficult. I remember the first time I read this, I read Maharaj Raghuguna's response, and I thought, this makes sense. This is something sensible. And Prabhupada actually seems to agree with that. In several places in his purport, he says, this is a practical philosophy. In some case, in his purport to some verses, Prabhupada says, in the verse where Maharaj Raghuguna says that, even though the suffering is from the body, we still experience the suffering, so the suffering is real. Prabhupada says, here we see the difference between Mayavad philosophy and the practical philosophy of the Vaishnavas, whereas the Vaishnavas understand that suffering is not illusory and so on. And so there is an admittance that there's some truth in these teachings, and the first time I read this, I still very clearly remember it. I really liked this idea. I thought there's some real wisdom here. This is not just a spirituality that's sort of entirely devoid of our life in this world, but this is something that is grounded in reality, something that is real, something that is something we can relate to. And then Jad Bharata responds, and he says, ha, you think you're very learned, but actually you're a great fool. And he says, My dear king, although you are not at all experienced, you're trying to speak like a very experienced man. Consequently, you cannot be considered an experienced person. An experienced person does not speak the way you are speaking about the relationship between a master and a servant, or about material pains and pleasures. These are simply external activities. Any advanced experienced man, considering the absolute truth, does not talk in this way. And so all the ideas that we might like so much and that we might think are so balanced or grounded, suddenly are wiped off the table. And in the rest of the chapter and in the next chapters, Jad Bharata is going to teach Maharaj Rahuvana why his practical philosophy, as Prabhupada calls it, or his very sensible ideas, are really not that sensible, and there's something that is deeper, something higher at stake here or involved here. And the teachings of, or the opinion of Maharaj Rahugana, Jad Bharata continues to say, he says it's not entirely wrong, and there, you have some grounds to believe this, because this is what the Vedas teach. And in the first verses of his teaching, he says this is what the Veda teaches, but you should know that the Vedas are limited. The Vedas won't give you everything that you need to know. And a few verses later, he says, the Vedas, although an excellent source, are insufficient to bring about direct knowledge of the truth. And so Maharaj Rahugana has been thinking in terms of the regulations and the norms that are set in the Vedas for ritual performance, for varnashram, for living a life in society that respects the order of society and sustains the structure of society. And it's something that perhaps the reason why I felt so uncomfortable reading Maharaj Jad Bharata's response to Maharaj Rahugana so many years ago was because there's some attachment to this idea. There's some attachment that we have a certain position in the world, and with that position comes a responsibility, but with that position also comes a responsibility from other people to respect your position and to treat you as holding that position. You're a king only because other people are not kings. You're a servant because somebody else is not a servant, and so your identity is defined by other people, and other people, you know, sort of have to act in accordance with that position. Otherwise, you have no position. If no one respected Maharaj Rahugana as a king, he would not be a king. And so Jad Bharata is pointing out that there's something else at stake here. Even though this idea is not entirely wrong, Maharaj Rahugana is attached to his position as a king, as will become clearer, particularly in the next chapter. Jad Bharata directly states this, that you think you're a great king, but actually, you know, think again. Jad Bharata starts teaching him about he's elaborating on his first point, that the things that relate to the body do not relate to the self, and therefore the pleasures and pains that are experienced by the body are not the pleasures and pains of the self, and the position one acquires in this world, it has nothing to do with the self. But all of these things, Jad Bharata teaches, have all to do with the mind. The mind is the center of this. And he starts to explain that the mind is the cause of material existence. The mind is the function of the subtle body that has to do with contemplation, with being aware of the world around us. It's the function of the subtle body that makes sankalpas, that makes intentions, that has a resolve, that makes a decision that this is what I'm going to do, and that does vikalpa, that decides I'm not going to do this. And so from that comes the action that is done by the body. But Jad Bharata says that all these things have all the actions that we do with the body all have their seat in the mind. And so the mind is a central idea. And it is he teaches that the mind is the cause of not just of the actions that we do now with our body, but is the cause of the very body itself. We have a similar teaching found in the 11th canto in the Avanti Brahmana. Again, a person who renounced the world and lived like a madman, sort of, you know, wanting to be left alone by the world. And his realization is too that the mind is the cause of all suffering, and that the mind is the cause of our bondage and also the cause of our liberation. And he says, he has a very nice verse where he says, Deham mano matram imam grihitva, that having accepted this body, this deha, which is mano matram, which consists merely of the mind, he teaches that the body we have is just made up of the mind in the sense that it is the product of the mind. It is because of our thoughts, it's what you think of that you become. That's the idea behind it. And of course, Jadbharata is very much aware of this truth. Earlier in this canto, we've heard how Jadbharata used to be known just as Bharata, and he was a great king. And at some point, he decides to renounce his kingdom, and he moves to the forest, and he lives there a very simple ascetic life. But one day, he finds a little deer that's been left behind by its mother. Its mother died, and so there's this young fawn that is without protection and without shelter. And so he decides, as a saintly person who's concerned for the welfare of all beings, he decides, okay, I should take care of this. This little fawn has no one to take care of. But in the course of his care of that fawn, he becomes so attached to it, he's contemplating it constantly, by his constant thought of that little deer, in his next life he becomes a deer. And so his thoughts create his next life. And for a lifetime, he has to inhabit the body of a deer. But he was blessed by the Lord, the Bhagavatam tells us, so that he could remember his past life and he could remember how he got into this position. And when he died as a deer, he was reborn as Jadbharata, as the dull Bharata. And he decided, okay, enough of this. I've wasted so much time already. So now I'm just not going to engage with the world whatsoever. And I'm just going to pretend I'm a madman. I'm dumb. I'm deaf. I have nothing to do with this world. And that's when Maharaj Rahugana met him. And so Jadbharata has a real experience of how the mind creates our existence, how the mind creates the body we accept, and how the mind causes us to be bound to matter. But then a few days ago, we heard that he says the mind is the cause of bondage, but the mind is also the cause of liberation. And it is the mind has these two functions. And so then one might wonder, well, how is this possible? How can the mind both bind and liberate? And in the previous verse, in verse 8, Jadbharata began to explain this. And he said that if the mind is attached to the gunas, if the mind is attached to the qualities of this world, then it's the cause for bondage. If the mind is nairgunya, is disassociated from the gunas, is not attached to the gunas, then it becomes the source, the means of liberation. It no longer binds us. And he gives the example, a very nice example, of, he says, imagine there's a lamp, like a little clay lamp with sort of oil in it and a wick in it. He says, if the wick is improperly placed in the lamp and rests on the clay or on the metal or whatever the lamp is made of, then the flame will not be proper. The flame will be flickering, and there will be a lot of smoke that is generated. And this is what happens when the mind is attached to matter. When the wick is attached to the lamp itself, then the lamp does not burn properly, and there's a lot of smoke that is generated. There's a lot of ignorance that is generated. But when the wick is placed properly in the center of the lamp and does not touch the base of the lamp, Then, he says, then there's illumination. Then knowledge appears. And from that knowledge, liberation arises. And in this verse, from this verse onwards, he begins to explain how this actually works and how the functions of the mind can lead both to liberation and to bondage. And so here in this verse, he says, there's 11 vrittis, there's 11 functions or 11 modes of being of the mind. He says there's 5 senses of knowledge, that 5 senses that allow you to gain knowledge. So we have the eyes, we have the ears, we have the sense of taste, we have the sense of touch, and so on. And there's 5 karmendriyas, 5 action or faculties, the faculties of the arms, the legs, the evacuation and procreation, and so on. And these different senses constitute 10, and then there's an 11th one, which is the abhimana, as this verse says. That's the false ego, that's the identification, that's the pride that comes when one identifies with this body. And these 11, they constitute the functions of the mind. The mind is always conscious of one of these 11 things. So either it is conscious of engaging, of the body engaging in a particular action, or it is conscious of certain sense perceptions that the senses bring to the mind, or it is conscious of the false ego. It is conscious of the false identification with the body. It thinks that it is the body. It thinks it is what can be seen with the senses. And the next verses will elaborate on this and say that these things combine together. The senses perceive objects, and these objects are in some sense, again, they're 11 in nature, but then in combination with different forms of matter, in combination with time, in combination with different actions and so on, it says there is sahasrasha, satasha, kotishascha. The objects of the mind become 1,000-fold, 100-fold, 1,000,000,000-fold. And so these are the things our mind becomes aware of, and this is how we get trapped into matter, and this is how we get trapped into this world. Now, and of course, the biggest problem in this whole picture is not so much the fact that the mind is aware of the sense objects and that the senses give the knowledge of the external world, transport that to the mind and communicate that to the mind. But the problem is really the 11th function of the mind, the abhimana, the ahankara, the false ego. It's the identification with what we see, the identification with this body, the identification with the things related to this body, such as our family, our nation, our community, our possessions, our house, our car, our books, our whatever we own, whatever we possess. And that's the real problem. It is not that Jadbharata is teaching that in order to become self-realized, you have to stop perceiving, you have to sort of, you know, stop seeing the world, stop hearing the world, stop smelling the world, and so on. But it is rather you have to stop identifying with this. You have to cease seeing yourself as part of this body. And part of the way in which you do that is by merely becoming aware of this. Part of what Jadbharata is trying to convey to Maharaj Rahugana is that once you know the functions of the mind, once you know how the mind functions and how the mind perceives certain things, then you can become aware of this. And there's a verse in the Bhagavata that says that deho, asava, akshi, manavaha, bhutamatram, that the body, the asava, the life airs, the pranas that are within the body, the Akshi, the senses, the manava, the internal senses, the mind, the intelligence, and so on, and bhuta matram, and all the elements of this world. Atmanam anyamcha vidhu paramyat. These things, these objects, they do not know atmanam, they do not know themselves, they're not aware of themselves, and they're not aware anyat, of the others as well. The eye cannot see itself, the ear cannot hear itself, and so on. They're not aware of each other, but neither can they be aware they're not aware of themselves, and neither can they be aware of the others. But sarvam puman veda gunascha tadgyo. But that above this is the self, is the puman, is the living being, and he is aware of them, and he's aware of the gunas, of their qualities. Tadgyo, because he knows them, he can be perceptive of them, and so this is the first teaching that Maharaj Rahugana is trying to make, that the senses, the mind, the body, all these material elements, they're dull, they're dead, there's no life in them, and they're not aware of themselves, and they cannot be aware of something else. And so we identify with the mind because we think that the mind is aware of the mind. But actually the mind is not aware of the mind, but we are aware of the mind. And so that's the first teaching. We have to realize that we are the witness of all the transformations, of all these vrittis of the mind. We become aware of the sensory perceptions that are communicated to the mind. We should become aware of our false identification with the body. But at the moment, we don't. We sort of conflate these two. We don't make a distinction between that. But then the Bhagavatam takes this a step further and says, and as we'll see in the coming days, Jadbharata takes this a step further as well. It is not just enough to realize that I'm not the mind and that I'm merely aware of the mind. But you have to take this a step further. So, sarvam pumam veda gunascha tadgyo. The self, the soul, is aware of the functions of the mind, is aware of the body and so on, even though the body is not aware of that. But then, naveda sarvagyam anantamishe. But the self, the soul, is not aware of something higher than itself, and it's not aware of sarvagyam, of he who knows everything, of anantam, the unlimited Isha, the unlimited Lord. And so we have to take this a step further, and we'll see in the next verses, Jadbharata is teaching this, that the functions of the mind are there, and we are distinct from the functions of the mind, and but above ourselves is the Lord, and the Lord is the one who's orchestrating this. The Lord is the one who makes us aware of the functions of the mind. The Lord is the one who in a sense continues our existence in this world, but is also the source of becoming free of this world. And so Jadbharata's teachings all center around the mind, and he says the primary important is to learn to control this mind. At the very end of the chapter, he says, don't give this mind even a little space. Just really keep it close. Curb the reins of the mind, and don't let it stray off even a little bit, because as soon as you give it a little bit, it will, you know, you give it a hand, it'll take an arm. You give it an inch, it'll take a mile. And before you know it, you'll become a deer, like I became a deer. So be careful. Don't let this get out of control. And of course, one might wonder, well, how will we control the mind? Well, one thing is, as he's teaching in these verses here, is one way to control the mind is just becoming aware of the mind, is becoming aware of how the mind functions, is becoming aware of how we identify with the body, how we identify with the mind. We learn this discrimination. We learn that the self is really the observer, is not the agent of the act of the actions of the body, but is merely observing what is happening in the body. But then the next practice that one should engage in is, as he mentions later, is one should not use the mind, or as he actually mentioned in the previous verse, he says, how is the mind the cause for bondage? The mind is the cause of bondage if it contemplates the gunas, the qualities of this world. How is the mind the cause of liberation? It is when it is nirgunya, Nirgunya. It is one that is free from the modes of material nature. And as he'll explain in a few verses, what is really free from the modes of material nature? It is the Lord. And so the best way to control the mind is to focus the mind on the Lord and to meditate on him, to think of him, to make our sankalpas, our intentions, not intentions for material enjoyment, for things that have to do with the body, but make them intentions to please the Lord. Anukulyasya sankalpa. We should make the sankalpa, the intention, the determination to for anukulyasya, for things that are favorable, for things that the Lord likes, for things that will help us in our spiritual life. And in a way, it's not something that's done mechanically. It's not something we experience many of us. It's not easy to do this in a way. In one sense, it's easy to think of the Lord. It seems like an easy solution, but on the other hand, it's not terribly easy either. Many of us who chant japa will try to focus on the Hare Krishna mantra when we chant. It is not terribly easy, even though we know that the name of Krishna is none different from Krishna. Still, our mind wanders, and still our mind goes into different directions, because our mind is accustomed to acting in a particular way. Our mind is accustomed. The Bhagavatam says it: karma sankalpa vikalpa manaha. The mind is that which has the sankalpa and the vikalpa, the decision to do something and the decision to not do something, for karma, for fruit of activities, for enjoyment. That's how our mind is trained, that's how our mind is formed. And suddenly we have to teach our mind not to go for enjoyment, not to go for the pleasures and pain, not to identify with the mind. We have to learn to create a distance with that and no longer see the sufferings that the mind undergoes as the sufferings that we undergo, no longer see the pleasures that the mind experiences as being our pleasures. And that's not an easy task. It is not something that will come easily, but luckily it's not something that we have to do alone either. As Jadbharata later will explain, the way to do this is by bhakti, by devotion to Guru and to Hari, to Guru and God, to Guru and Krishna. And he says, in this way, one can gradually come to control the mind. Because what happens then is once you give yourself, you surrender to Krishna, you surrender to the Guru, what happens is there's grace that comes, there's help that comes. And so we're no longer just merely struggling on our own to control our mind and to drag it away from the enjoyment of this world, but we pray to Krishna that may he capture our mind, and we know from the descriptions of Krishna that Krishna is Manohara. Krishna is the one who seizes the mind, who grasps the mind, who attracts the mind, because he's wonderful. He's Krishna. He's all attractive. He's the one who draws our mind to him. And so that becomes our prayer, that we learn to disassociate ourselves from the mind and therefore from the pleasures and pains of the mind. We learn to see that when we experience something good in this world, when we experience something bad, they really don't touch the self, the soul, and they have nothing to do with the self, but we only suffer because we identify with it. And so what Maharaj Rahugana earlier said, that we, you know, I think this idea that there is no suffering doesn't make sense because we identify with the mind and therefore there is suffering. That is true, but once we learn to stop identifying with the mind, we go beyond suffering. And even though there may be sensations of pain and pleasure, there is no suffering because there's no enjoyment because there's no identification with it. And so we learn to do this by gaining knowledge, having the lamp that is burning properly illuminate our understanding. But at the same time, we also ask for help, and we ask for help for the Lord to attract us, to draw our mind to him, to draw our mind away from matter. And this is the way our acharyas pray. Prabhupada taught us that the Hare Krishna mantra means, please engage us in your service, meaning please don't let me be engaged in the service of this world. Please don't let me have the attraction for this world, but please let me have attraction for you and serve you and be content in that service to you. We have a beautiful prayer by Rupa Goswami from one of his songs where he says, Man manasa madhukaram arpaya nijapada pankaja makarande. Where he says that, O Lord, my mind, he says, place the bumblebee, that is my mind, in the whirl of the lotus that is your feet. And he's not saying, may my mind be attracted to this, but he's saying, place my mind there. Put my mind there, attract me in such a way that I'm in the whirl of the lotus, not just in the lotus, but in the whirl of the lotus, so that when the lotus closes, I'm trapped in there, and I cannot leave, and I cannot but think of you. And so that should be our prayer, not just that we think, oh, one day it would be nice if I can think of Krishna, but rather pray to Krishna that please let me think of you, please draw my mind to you, please draw my mind away from this world, so that my mind may become, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, the mama mana mandire, my mind may become a temple for you, and my mind may become your abode, and rather than the abode of all the enjoyments of this world, rather than the abode of everything we perceive. And so we learn to understand that the senses cannot know themselves. They're dull. They have no consciousness. But we become aware of them, as the Bhagavatam says. But then we, at this point, naveda sarvagyam anantamishe. But then we are not aware of the sarvagyam, of he who knows everything, of the unlimited Lord. But we pray that may we become aware of you, and by becoming aware of you, become aware even stronger of the difference between our minds and ourselves, and may this in this way be our mind the source of liberation, and suffering cease as well as enjoyment cease, and so we no longer caught in this, we no longer are in danger of becoming a deer or a mouse or a worm or a god or a demon or anything else that you can think of in this world, but we become content wherever we are, and we become devotees whose minds are fixed on the Lord. So I'll end here. This little clock is broken. So I apologize. I went on a bit longer. Any questions or comments? No, the 11th here is not the mind. Sometimes the 11th is said to be the mind, but here, the way Jad Bharata explains it is the 11th is the false ego. And he says these are the vrittis, the functions, or the modes of being of the mind. And because these are the things the mind is aware of. And so we're aware of whatever we perceive with our senses, or whatever we do with our senses. I mean, in some ways, perhaps the word to think of the action senses, the karmendriyas, the senses might be a little confusing, but you can think of them as faculties. You know, there are faculties of action, our faculty of you know walking, our faculty of evacuation, our faculty of procreation, and so on. These are the means of the functions of our karmendiras, our action-oriented, our working senses, as Prabhupada translates them. And so we're either aware of us engaging in a particular action with these senses, or of being aware of a particular object in this world through the other senses, or we're aware of the ahankara, of the identification with this body. And so these are the things we become aware of. And the object of the ahankara is will be explained in the next verse. Jadbharata says the main object of the ahankara, of the false ego, is mama, is the sense of mine. And he says, and some say it's also aham, so we can say there's 12. And then and he sort of distinguishes them. We'll see tomorrow in the next verse. And so these are the objects of the false ego. And so we're aware either of aham, of I, or mama, or mine, or anything, any of the objects of the senses, or any of the actions of the working senses. Does that? Sir? Sorry, what's the... No, the mind is the receptacle of the senses. It's sometimes considered the sixth or the 11th sense, depending on whether the working senses are included or not. But it's one of the senses in the sense that it becomes aware of whatever else the other senses. It's basically, you know, I see something and my sense of sight is just perceiving something. So say I there's a marching band or something that walks past, and you know, you have the people playing their instruments and beating their drums, and if I see them, then I see my sense of sight perceives the form of them. I see them moving around, and I see, you know, the guy beating the drum, his sticks moving up and down and so on. But then the sight of hearing hears the music or you know the noise they produce, and or the sound they produce. Let's put it the sound they produce. But then the sense of hearing is it does not see them; it just hears it. And so, but we put these two images together because of the mind, because these two separate perceptions. One of seeing the people, one of hearing the sound that they produce, is sort of communicated to the mind, is brought to the mind. And in the mind, we put these two things together. Sorry. And so that's the function of the mind. It's not that the mind has a separate sense object in a way, but it just brings all the sensory perceptions together and makes us, you know, sort of allows us to make sense of them. And then, of course, based on that, the other function of the mind is that based on that, it leads to karma, to desire. The mind is the seat of desire, and based on those desires, if I like the sound of the marching band, the music of the marching band, then whenever I might desire to hear it again, and this will then lead to an action. Whenever I hear a marching band, I'll run out the house and go and see them and enjoy the spectacle. If I don't like them, whenever I hear them coming, I'll close my windows and run away and, you know, put earplugs in or something. And so this is what the mind does. It gathers the sensory perceptions. It creates desires based on those experiences. If it's something pleasurable, we'll desire to have it again. If it's something unpleasurable, we won't desire it again. And then the sankalpa vikalpa comes. Well, there's a resolution that I'll do this again, or there's a resolution that I won't do this again because this was not very nice. So that's what the mind. That's how the mind works. Does that clarify? Yeah, this was Jadbharata himself speaking. He says, the Vedas, although an excellent source, are insufficient to bring about direct knowledge of the truth. What is meant here by the Vedas is the four Vedas is what we generally call the Karmakanda, the the section that deals with karma, that deals with fruit of action, and particularly Vedic ritual action. And the idea is basically, it's the texts that have to do, that teach us about fruit of action, about how to worship different gods for different purposes, basically in order to live a happy life in this world. But it also teaches us about varna and ashram and so on. That's the other side of Karmakanda. It teaches about how to act in this world and how to structure society, how to act responsibly in society. And it's what Maharaj Rahugana was taking into consideration when he was responding to Jadbharat. He said, I am a king. I have a responsibility. I can't just throw this out the window. I am a king, so therefore I have to, you know, I have to ride on a palanquin, because otherwise people won't take me seriously. And this is my dharma. This is my duty in society. Jadbharata's response is that no, this is true and this is good, but this is good only up until a certain point. So your identification as a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra, as having a particular function in society, is good, but it's not, it's not ultimately good, because there's still an identification with the body. And we see this with Maharaj Rahugana, even though he had some knowledge of the idea of he's not the body, he was still attached to the body. And he was still feeling the pleasures and pains of this body, and therefore he would still continue acting in this world in order to experience the pleasure again and to avoid the pain again that he experienced in the past. And so he would continue to be reborn. And because we need to go beyond that, we find the same idea in Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna, his first his reasons to not fight are all reasons that are based on Dharma Shastra and on Karmakanda. And Krishna says, no, forget about this. And later, towards the end of the second chapter, he says that the Vedas are about the three gunas. They're about the three qualities of this world. And he says, Nistray Gunya Bhavarjuna, become transcendent, transcend these gunas, meaning transcend the Vedas in the process, in a way. Because the Vedas center around the idea that you have a particular dharma, you have a particular function in society, but it doesn't teach you much about that you're not really that function in society, that you're something beyond that. And so that's why they're an excellent source. They're a way of uplifting more people, because it's a step up from just ordinary life, because it regulates you. It tells you that you can't just live any way you want, but you have to live taking the bigger picture into account. You have a responsibility towards society. You cannot just act however you please, however you like, but by being a human being, you have a place in society. You have a place in the world, and it is your duty to act responsibly in that position. And so it's not just about you, basically, but it's about the good of the people, really. And it's a bit of a difficult thing to realize, in a way. As Anuradha likes to say, we tend to think of human rights. We're always talking about human rights, but the Vedas, the Karmakanda, stresses it's about being a right human rather than about human rights. It's not about I have rights, but I have a duty. I have a responsibility to be a proper person in relation to other people, and that's a good thing. That's that lifts you up. But if you get stuck there, then that's not a good thing, because you have to go beyond that and come to the understanding that yes, I'm a human being and I have responsibilities, but really I'm not a human being, because the identity, as Jadbharata will say, at the end of this chapter, when Jadbharata is done teaching, Maharaj Rahugana turns to Jadbharata and says, actually, I still don't understand what it is that you're saying. And he repeats his initial question, and he says, can you explain it to me again? And then Jadbharata starts teaching it to him again, but then he emphasizes that, okay, So you didn't get my first teaching, so I'll try and explain to you in a different way. It says, yes, you are a king, but you'll die, and you'll no longer be a king. And so therefore, but you'll still be you. You'll still have an identity as the soul. And because that identity of a king is temporary, therefore it has it's not permanent. And because it is not permanent, it's not a real identity, because identity means, you know, something that you're eternally. It has no real existence in a sense. And so that's the idea that he wants Rahugana to understand, that you have a function as a king at the moment, but don't bet all your money on that in a way, because you'll die and then what? So learn to see beyond that and learn to take that into consideration, that you're not this body, you're not a king, and so your responsibilities are not just the responsibilities of a king, but are the responsibilities of a soul, and that's more important. Does that help? I mean, in a way, the system is there so that to allow people to transcend the system. Varnashram is there so that people can go beyond Varnashram, really, so that they can realize they're not a king or a priest or a farmer or whatever. Krishna in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, when he at some point when he's teaching Uddhava, he does the same as he does in the Bhagavad Gita in the 10th chapter. He says, among this I'm that, and among this I'm that. And then he says, Durjayanam aham mana. Among things that are very hard to conquer, I am the mind. Meaning it's the most difficult thing to control, to keep in control. It may seem impossible to control the mind, but we're told repeatedly that it is possible. Krishna says, you know, it takes practice, and it takes renunciation. It takes detachment. So we become detached from this world. We don't engage in everything that our mind wants to engage in, and so we kind of restrain it a bit. And then it's practice. We repeatedly try and bring it back to something, to Krishna, basically, to divine things. Then the mind will be controlled. The Bhagavatam tells us if we do it that way, then the nature of God, the nature of Krishna, is such that our mind will be focused on Him. But now our difficulty is that our mind is accustomed to engage in all sorts of things, and we're accustomed to desire sense gratification, and that's what the mind longs for, and so we have a mind like that, and now we're basically telling it, don't go to there, but go here, go to Krishna, And so we have to try and learn it something new. And that's difficult because our mind is accustomed to going in that particular direction. Sort of there's a groove that is grafted. If you take a marble, you know, you have a piece of wood and there's a groove that is grafted, and you want to if you've ever cut like things with a paper cutter, like a knife, and you know, you're cutting cardboard, and as soon as you once go off, it's very hard to kind of go straight again, because your knife will always go back into that groove and you just make it thick, deeper and deeper. And that's kind of how our mind is. We're always going back to this particular thing of enjoying this world, whereas we want to pull it away from that. We want to pull it away into a different direction. And that's where the tension arises from. We're not used to think of Krishna. We're used to think of things that we can see, things that we can perceive, but we cannot perceive Krishna. When we can perceive the Murti here, but our senses are not always satisfied with that, and because it, you know, we have desires for other things. And so the real key to control the mind is the mind is the seat of karma, is the seat of desire, and the real key to control the mind is to control desire. To purify desire, to give up the desires for this world and replace them with desires for Krishna. And once that happens, then your mind, Prahlad Maharaj says, I cannot but think of Krishna. My mind is attracted to the Lord like a piece of iron is attracted to a magnet. I cannot help it. It just goes naturally. Queen Kunti prays, may my mind flow to you like the Ganges flows to the river, to the ocean. It's just nothing can stop it. It will always flow down and reach the ocean. And so that's the, you know, you can obtain that if there's no desires, if there's no desires for enjoyment that are there, and the desire is purely the desire for Krishna. So the real question is then, how do we control desire? And that is by not acting upon our material desires, and trying to focus on the desires for Krishna, and cultivate love, which is generated by engaging in devotional service. Gradually, the love awakens, and then you know, our mind will be naturally attracted. I think it's breakfast time. But Pandu wants to say something anyway. You all have breakfast. Think of Krishna while you enjoy. Grantharaj Sriman Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Especially why I read that the Lord appears in the form.